Accession number 30277, Reel 4.
I was going to talk about possible accidents that may have occurred in the training process, because often what you hear is that more people are killed in actual training than they are in the operation. What do you recall of it, if any?
Only one of the small arms instructors, he always said to us, with the submachine guns, you get certain submachine guns like Austin or the Sten, which we had all of those, and the Owen, they jam. And he said, never put it on the ground and clear it with your boot. And on this day he did. And it was just too close. It went right through his skull. He was sort of still alive, but they put him on the barge and took him back, but he was dead on arrival. That was the only serious thing that I can remember happening on the 8 weeks that I was there.
How did it affect the rest of the chaps? How did it affect the group?
I think they were pretty hardened, and it didn't worry anybody.
Presumably, we're talking about all the explosives. You're talking, we're getting a bit closer to the realities of a war situation.
Exactly. Yeah.
How is your view possibly altering in relation to war, in relation to what war might result in for you?
Oh, I think I can sum it up in saying that, as somebody asked me once, what chance did you give yourself? And I said, well, I thought quite seriously we had a 50-50 chance of survival once we knew a little more about it and had been through the parachuting.
Okay, well, you talk about foal boating and being a hazardous affair. Tell us about your experience with foal boating.
The most most hairy experience we had was the night that we were tried out for our navigation, and it was pitch black, no moon. We were paired off into couples, given a compass bearing to the buoy at the mouth of the Mary River, which is several miles away, and off we went. We hadn't been told what the tide was doing, unfortunately, and as this other fellow and I paddled away, we could hear this slapping and banging going on, and I said to him, what the hell's that noise? He says, oh, it's just the sharks and porpoises fighting. So I thought, what the hell are we doing out here? And then a little while later, half, three quarters of an hour, I suppose, the paddle struck bottom, and I said, I've hit something, Reg. And next minute he hit something, and we were on Little Woody Island, another little island. Suddenly realised the four-knot tide has swept us way off course. So we took another bearing where we reckoned the mouth of the Mary River would be and paddled away. About midnight we gave it up, we couldn't find it. And we turned around and headed back for Fraser. After about another half an hour, we could see the hurricane lamp that had been lit on Fraser Island to show us where to come, and got home safely. Everybody got home all right. It was a bit of a experience. Yes.
Presumably one that wouldn't necessarily fill you with a huge amount of confidence.
Not a lot of enthusiasm for nighttime work, no. So anyway, we didn't get a Guernsey for going to Western Australia and Garden Island to do the midget submarine course because we didn't navigate properly.
But obviously you talk about some of these things in the book, and I did want to talk to you about training at Mount Martha and what was involved with Mount Martha.
We were sent once selected for Samut. Some of us were sent to Mount Martha, where we had a small establishment, and at that stage we were going to go into we hadn't been told where we were going, but wherever we were going in the islands, we were going to go by submarine, and foal boats and inflatable boats with our stores in it. And some of the party would go down to the pier where they would travel out to sea with these kerosene tins, which were wrapped in hessian and then roped up, filled with sand to simulate stores and make it bit more difficult. They would go out to sea, out to Port Phillip Bay, and then turn and come into the cliffs at I can't remember the name now. Others of us would be waiting ashore to see if we could hear the outboard motors and or the paddles or anything like that. And I spent two nights listening for them and never heard a thing. Not until they were right on the beach. And then it was hard work getting those tins out and loading them into the truck for the next time. At about this time, it was decided that parachuting was the way to go, and we were off to Richmond Air Base to do the training and the seven jumps.
All right, well, let's talk about that. What was involved with learning how to parachute out of a plane?
I missed a bit of it through having some teeth trouble. I did do the wrestling. Yeah, they had an Australian champion wrestler. You had to get in the ring with him and have a go. It was hopeless, of course.
Well, to what sort of level had you sort of attained hand-to-hand combat? I mean, how successful were you? Could you kill someone with, you know,
your bare hands?
Your finger or something?
No, no way, no. No, we weren't that good. Some of the people would have been better than the signals people.
Well, what were you being taught in a hand-to-hand situation?
On Fraser, yes. It was mainly just unarmed combat without any weapons, throwing people around and gripping them and assimilating, breaking their necks and stuff like that. Nothing in the way of firearms or knives or anything of that. I think they kept away from that bit because, you know, some of them got pretty excited when they got hurt a bit and might have been tempted to do a bit of damage. But the training at Richmond Air Base, we had to, the part that I got involved in, they had a few old parachutes, and they had this enormous aircraft engine set up to blow you along. So you got in front of it with this old parachute on, and they started this engine up with this enormous propeller on it and blew like hell, and of course it dragged you. The idea was before the seat of your pants got ripped out, you had to get out of your harness. that was one of the things, so that you knew, as with when we came down in the parachutes, you usually twist the box and get ready to hit it as soon as you hit the ground, so that you're out of your harness if there's a wind blowing or if you're dropping in water. One of the hardest things to do is to jump out of the 30-foot tower onto the Flying Fox, because you can see everything around. You know you're at height, whereas up in the aeroplane you just look straight ahead and it's just blue sky and there's nothing there to tell you this is silly, I'm up high. So that's the hardest thing to do. One of the Malays, he couldn't do it. He just couldn't do it. Yeah.
And what happened?
Oh, he was sent back. He sent back to Fraser. He went in on, I forget now, he went in on another job, but not in parachuting, of course.
Well, presumably, at a certain point, you're sort of testing yourself apart from anything else.
Yes, yeah.
So here you are, 30 foot up on this... But you're attached to a Flying Fox. It's not like you've got to jump off and...
No, it's just that you can see all the trees and the buildings there, and you know that you're up high, and your brain's telling you now you don't do this.
So how did you do it?
Oh, everybody did it, excepting this one bloke. It's just you hesitate. You hesitate when you get there. And then... of course, you get...
Presumably you get into a plane not long after that.
Very, very soon after that, you get into the DC-3, and he goes across the DZ, and one parachutist jumps out. You get to the door, you're holding on, and the jump master is watching the red and the green lights. When the red's on, you're ready. When the green's on, he gives you a hit under the elbow. And that gives you such a fright that you're immediately out. Do one at a time in that first or second day. You go around, drop out, then the next one... He does another circuit and he drops the next one out.
What was it like the first time? Suddenly you're out of the plane.
Yes, suddenly you're out and hopefully that thing's going to open. They all... no trouble with them. The chap who came after me, I was on the ground and he was the next one out. This was the first ever jump. And the plane came round, he jumped, and we saw his parachute develop. They usually develop and then they sort of collapse with the pressure and then develop again. And his started to develop, but it didn't fully. It only half developed, and he had a rigging line over the other half. And it just fluttered and fluttered and came sideways and then dropped him about 50 feet, and then it started to half develop again. And it did that twice on the way down and just developed before he hit the ground, so he was all right, other than that he was shaking and wanted a cigarette badly. Yeah, then you do...
What's it like to be floating down? Here you are, the first time. And this is where you do see the ground, presumably.
Yes. It's a very peaceful thing, and I guess that's why there's a big following for parachuting, even in civilian days. You know, it's quite a sport. Later in that week, we do the stick parachuting, and that is, you are all as close as you can get together. And the green light goes on and you're all pushing to get out as quick as you can. Going back to the single jumps, the first time ever, the little chap in front of me, he couldn't make it. He got close to the door and then went in a dead faint. So he was back to his unit. He wasn't in our unit actually. He was a medical man who was going to do a parachute into a certain spot to help people. But when he got to the door, he just flaked out, and so they had to grab him, and then I went out.
No second chances?
No, too risky. Another thing, we have to go and watch them folding our parachutes. The last, before you do your seventh jump, you have to pack your own parachute. And they oversee it, of course. They have a big sign up in there, in the parachute packing shed: if it doesn't open, bring it back. Something to that effect. And that was about all that was exciting in the at Richmond.
Well, after your parachute, I understand all the members qualified. Four of you were selected to return to Melbourne and collect stores and equipment.
That is correct, yes.
Which were going to be railed to Brisbane, I understand. So exactly. Things are starting to happen. You're sort of...
Yes, we're on our way, more or less.
How long had all this training taken?
It was quite a while, actually. 8 weeks on Fraser Island and then down to Mount Martha. Probably spent a month down there, 3 months. I would say 6 months. Yeah.
To what degree were people sort of starting to get a bit edgy? Come on, let's get out there, and I mean, the Japanese aren't waiting for us or anything.
I think they were. They knew they were going to, they were committed more or less, so I don't think they were getting toey. Although I have known other people to get, some of the other blokes to get a bit toey and want to get on with the job. So anyway, as you say, we had the stores, which were in a sealed compartment. With a little passenger compartment on the end. The four of us were in that. And we got to a railway shunting yards in out of Sydney, and had a little bit of bother there. We were told by the guard that our train wouldn't be pulling out until after midnight. And he said, you can all get cleaned up down at the roundhouse. There's hot showers and etc. down there. We all did all that and went into, caught a train into Sydney to try and find some food, but we're unlucky. Came back again and our train had disappeared. So it was back to Sydney and jump aboard an express which was bound for Brisbane, and it was one of the major stops. Our train was shunted off the line to let the express go through, so we were lucky. We were thinking of all kinds of court-martials for that little episode, so we never let it out of our sight after that. Got to Brisbane. Handed it over to other authorities. Spent a night at Milton Tennis Courts, and then by truck to to Leyburn. The locals call it Leyburn, I understand, where we were living in a forestry worker's cottage. That we were there for some time, I suppose, could be 3 to 4 weeks we were there. I was the only one with a driver's license, so I had to drive the water truck to get our water supply.
And was anyone telling you anything about anything at this point, or had you just sort of been shunted around a pillar to post, learning all of these things for something?
At this stage, we were told that we were... Because Simut, we were speculating on Sumatra, because we, at that stage, we didn't know that Simut meant ant in Malay or any other thing. And we were speculating on Sumatra because of this. Sumatra sounded a bit Simut. We were told at that stage of the game it was Borneo. And we would be parachuting into central Borneo. An advance party first with 8 men, and the main party with 8 men would follow in a week.
Were you being told what the significance of Borneo was, why Borneo was being chosen for you?
No, it was just that the leaders, Major Carter, Tom Harrison, Bill Sosham, they had all worked in Borneo, knew the language well, and were selected for that purpose of leading us.